Phones are a little janky, but I think it's going to be all right.
I think you need to lower the volume a little. Hello.
Hey.
This is Chasing Sound.
So you're listening to KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby, streaming us live at koop.org.
Yeah.
Hey, Kanya.
Hey, Kirk. How's it going?
We just had way too much Asian food.
Yeah.
I don't know what part of the continent it was from, but the noodles are made fresh to order, so they tell us.
Hand-pulled, y'all.
Hand-pulled out of some type of machine.
Out of probably. What? We don't know.
Yeah, it could be a package. So tonight, I need to learn how to use the CD player.
Woo!
Because it's 2018 and no one uses those anymore, but you need to know one if you're going
to
be here at Co-op.
So one.
We made a whole show centered around one of the CDs that Kanya had in her car. And so tonight is the religious material show. You might be thinking, does that mean you're going to play a bunch of classic gospel? No.
Chanting all night long.
No, none of that. I am going to play secular music that references Jesus or some type of religious context. And we're calling it the religious material because that's probably about as religious as this show is ever going to get. Quick background. Gospel music is a subgenre of the bigger umbrella Christian music. And if you're completely unfamiliar with that, I can't help you. There's too much time to go into it. I was sort of, you know, I was raised in a Christian church. My first exposure to playing live music or playing with other musicians was at a church. So I'm fairly familiar with some of the more, at the time I was a kid going to church, late 80s, early 90s, there was sort of this crossover where commercial Nashville and commercial Christian music almost intersected, and there were some crossover artists like Amy Grant.
Oh, I remember kids liking her.
It just like suddenly it seemed like there were some Christian artists who were breaking into the mainstream and some country artists who were like dipping over into Christian music. It's a strange thing because when music all went digital and all went stolen, you know, there was only two genres that could still make a buck, and those were country music. Like to this day, there are country music fans who just have a CD player. They wouldn't know how to steal music if they wanted to. Like they just, whatever, you know, not to judge anyone, but that's awesome that they still buy music. So country artists, outside of a handful of pop singers, you know, Taylor Swift, stuff like that, can still make some bread. But country and Christian still have pretty decent CD sales, which is almost unheard of in the music world. So the creation, performance, and significance, and even the definition of gospel music kind of varies according to culture and social context, just like everything else, I guess. But it is composed and performed for different purposes, aesthetic, pleasure, religious, or ceremonial purposes. And just like anything else, for entertainment, I saw a lot of church lock-in concerts when I was like in junior high. There was a band, DC Talk, was like a hip-hop Christian group. And then, of course, we all remember the Christian metal sensation Stryper, the one Christian band that actually was like multi-platinum playing heavy metal.
The little nerdy kid used to wear that shirt on Beavis and Butthead. That's what
Exactly.
See, and my idea of religious music was going to the Hare Krishna temple with my mom, so I don't know what the heck you're talking about.
It depends on where, what angle, I guess, your folks were into, how much religious music you were exposed to. And it's, it's frowned upon, definitely, like the... friends in junior high that listened to metal. Certainly you didn't want to get caught dead listening to Stryper, but the truth is Stryper were a good band. They got like, they were the butt of every joke because whatever record label they were on would tour them with heavy metal bands who were obviously affiliated, maybe not with Satan, but definitely not with Jesus. And they would put them on tour with like Anthrax or put them at some metal festival. And kids would just throw stuff at them. Like they were the butt of every joke. But the funny thing is, if you go back now with all this hindsight and listen to their albums they put out in the 80s, you're like, they were actually one of the more talented metal bands. They had a much keener grasp on structure and harmonies and just a melodic sense. They had a very classical flow, and they were kind of a pioneer of a genre called power metal. But of course, no one will ever give them that credit. No one ever got past the fact that it's like, what? We have to see a Christian metal band before Anthrax comes on? That people just loved making fun of Stryper. But that's enough about Stryper. I might do a whole show about them. I actually did a podcast about Stryper a year or two ago. That was a lot of fun. So we are the CD that I picked out of Kanye's car, because I need to learn how to work the CD player, is Ritual de la Habitual by Jane's Addiction, their second and final album. And if... maybe you're not old enough to have really embraced the culture between, let's say, like 87 and 92 and the sea change in music. So I'll put it in an updated context. If you are old enough to have been around in the, let's say, the late 90s, you were in high school, you might remember a band, Neutral Milk Hotel. Much like Jane's Addiction, they didn't last very long. They had two proper studio albums and a couple of cleanup singles or maybe compilations of other things, just like Jane's Addiction. They had two proper studio albums and then like a cleanup record of singles and B-sides and then like a live record. But mainly it was two albums, Nothing Shocking and Ritual de la Habitual. But look at the impact they had. It's crazy how those two bands changed things so much and lasted for such a short amount of time. I guess, you know, you could even look to the Sex Pistols, one album, and look at how much they changed. Or the Beatles together, technically, from the whole thing start to finish was less than 10 years, but it shaped so many things. So I started to think, what show could I completely wrap around one of the songs off of Ritual de la Habitual? And I could have picked any song, but at first I thought albums that are better than Nirvana's Nevermind that came out before Nevermind and that people don't as often recognize. It's like, oh, this is actually better than anything that came out of that Seattle scene, though those albums were amazing. You know, Nevermind, Pearl Jam 10, Soundgarden's Bad Motorfinger. These were all very important records, but LA was doing Weird before Weird sort of caught on. And the bands that were making it happen out of LA were Jane's Addiction, Guns N' Roses, and NWA. You could say what you want about any other band that you used to love if you're like an older dude with long hair still that remembers your favorite LA band. Say what you will. Those are the three most important. Those are the bands that changed everything.
Well, Jane's A, we were listening to them when I was like 17, like before the
exactly.
Seattle. Exactly what you're saying. They made it here and we weren't that in the know. I mean, sure, we lived in Austin.
They were huge. Yeah. They came through.
I saw them live here.
Whenever the back room was about to close down, the Chronicle did extensive articles about the history of the place. And yeah, Jane's Addiction came through and played at the back room. And all those bands did their first, you know, Pearl Jam, the first time they came through Austin.
I didn't see them there. I saw them at the Coliseum, which is where that park is now. Anyway.
Well, that shows you the difference. Well, the first time they come through, and then by the next time they come through, they're the biggest band in the world. You know, by the time their second album came out, they were able to put together Lollapalooza, one of the biggest festivals celebrating alternative music in history. You know, if you don't know, if you're a bit younger and you have heard of Lollapalooza, I'm sure everyone has at this point, the starter of that whole thing was Perry Farrell from Jane's Addiction. He put the whole thing together while under the foot of a heavy heroin addiction. So shows you how much drive that guy had.
Right.
But this band is so important. And I thought, you know, I thought of all these different ways I could frame a show around it. And it was almost too easy. I had my pick of five different topics that would have easily centered around one song off of Ritual, De La Habitual, which was conveniently in Kanye's car 24/7. And so I decided on 3 days. It's a weird one because it eats up a lot of the time that I would normally like to gab, because it's the song is like over 10 minutes long. And 10 minutes, 48 seconds, according to our CD player here. But it's... I thought about that, and I thought about when I was a kid and I had this album on cassette and I used to listen to it. I used to sort of meditate to the second half of this album. The first half is a bunch of upbeat, kind of shorter numbers, a little bit more what you're used to. It's got Been Caught Stealing, which was a big hit for them, and Stop, which is another big hit they had. Both of those got fairly frequent MTV rotation. But when you flip over to the second side of Ritual, De La Habitual, it is four songs that are between 8 and 10 minutes long, if not longer, each. And they're just these powerful stories, and they're all a bit slower. I think at first when everybody got this album, they would just listen to the first side over and over again, just the upbeat stuff. And then as a little bit of time goes by, you realize, oh, the real magic is when you flip this tape over or flip this record over. The real magic is these 10-minute epic songs. And, you know, the band Guns N' Roses did the same thing with their second album, the two-volume Use Your Illusions. All of a sudden, there were multiple, like, seven songs that were 10 minutes long that really went into some weird space and were, like, the opposite of what you would consider radio-friendly music. So I thought about 3 days. It's mentioned, you know, Jesus gets his name dropped in the track, and just the religious context of it, how Perry Farrell was such a genius poet and singer. He never rhymed. His stuff never rhymed. Like, point to any other great band that never leaned on that in their lyrics. So, you know, rhyming, it's just something works with the human brain with a good pop song or a good rock song, and rhyming lyrics that are cleverly put together. You think of, like, Black Sabbath when Ozzy matched masses, like generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. He rhymed masses twice, but with different context. That's genius. But I've never heard anyone other than Perry Farrell do a whole rock group their entire career with almost zero rhyming. Where, I mean, these are just poems put to music, but it's not in an annoying way. You're like, oh, this guy can't write lyrics. You're like, oh, I guess we all thought you had to rhyme, and we were wrong. Like, Perry Farrell just proved everyone wrong. Like, no, you don't have to rhyme.
He's a storyteller.
He paints these images that are so vivid. I wish I could play every track off the second side, but it would eat up our whole show. There's a track, Then She Did, which is just gorgeous, talking about this girl. And it breaks it down to, like, you know, she was unhappy. We were sitting on these hard kitchen chairs, and she's this artist, and she's tortured just like you are. And it just gets more and more intense. But it starts off as this beautiful, wispy dream, almost like you're just barely waking up on your day off and everything's right with the world. And it just gets more and more intense and builds to these orchestral peaks that are just magic. It's such a great record. And the truth is, it kind of buries Nevermind. Like, Nevermind's a great album, and so is Pearl Jam 10, so is Bad Motorfinger. But as art, you know, whatever. We're not here to dish out opinions. It's just, as a crazy connoisseur of music, I've always sort of felt that. Like, boy, this, people don't talk about this album enough. Same with Neutral Milk Hotel. They kind of buried most of the bands from the late 90s. They brought it to this weird place. So, whatever. I'm going to learn to use the CD player tonight. So the first track we got going is 3 days. Oh, it's already kicked in. Sweet. Yeah, there's a little spoken word part here, and we're not going to talk to you for another 10 minutes while this track plays. So, yeah, stick around. We'll be back. But never will again. I miss you, my dear. Miss you, my dear. Zyola. I prepared the room tonight. I prepared the Christmas lights. Thank you.
night I lit a fire.
Shifts dead.
That's what I'm talking about.
Some good stuff.
Yeah, I hope we don't forget your CD here.
Yeah, hey.
I really needed a drink of water, but I could not walk away from that song. Man, I like that song so much. That's guitar solo, Dave Navarro. In case you ever wondered why people originally cared about that guy, even though he's kind of a goober now. The reason we cared about him was because the guitar solo is like that. That was actually voted... if you're not a guitar player, this kind of stuff doesn't matter too much. But if you're a dorky gearhead guitar player, the sort of guitar player magazines that put out lists of like 10 best solos, 100 greatest solos of all time, you love the human brain loves a good list. You like to see what got picked as number one so that you can hate them for putting your favorite thing as 32 when the something you like less is number one. Whatever. You love to hate those kinds of lists. And Dave Navarro's solo on that song, 3 Days, is always in the top 10 or 20 of those guitar player magazines referencing solos just because of the sheer emotion. I mean, he was a shredder. In the world of alternative music, he was the guy that had rack mount effects, a guitar with a whammy bar. Like, he played the guitars that the glam guys of LA, you know, Poison, stuff like that, he played the guitars that those guys played. He wasn't part of, you know, Slash... And Izzy Stradlin from Guns N' Roses came in and sort of changed everything. They're like, yeah, we're not doing rack mount effects or whammy bars. We're going to use Les Pauls and Marshall stacks like they did in 1973. Like, yeah. That's what we're going to be. And it would have been easy for Jane's Addiction to fit into that same pocket. Both those bands kicked off right around the same time. They were considered, you know, excluding NWA, let's just focus on guitar music. They were considered the bands, the only bands worth caring about in LA by hardcore music fans. So like everything else is forgettable. Like, yeah, they have cute girls in their videos, but if you're talking about songwriting, the two bands that hardcore audio heads, like Henry Rollins, he would talk about that in his diaries and his books that he put out when he's writing about going out and seeing shows in 85, 86, he's talking about Guns N' Roses and Jane's Addiction. And everyone else, as far as he was concerned, was just garbage. You know, he's like, or the last great LA band before that was Van Halen, maybe. And Dave Navarro used the tools of those sort of, you know, I hesitate to say glam because Bowie was glam, but that's what people called it at the time in the mid to late 80s when suddenly bands like Quiet Riot started putting out singles and selling a million records. All these metal guys were like, oh, you can get a lot more girls if you just write pop songs with heavy metal guitar solos and double bass drums, and you just sort of metal up pop music. And they use the kind of gear that Dave Navarro used, but man, listen to the difference. Listen to the sound Navarro gets out of it. All that emotion. He's still fast. He's every bit as fast and fluid as those guys, but he brought emotion to it. His guitar playing was almost like another vocal happening in the song. A lot like... Joey Santiago from the Pixies, where it's like you could almost take out the vocal and just have it be an instrumental band and just listen to the lead guitar.
Right.
That could almost carry the song. It was that much emotion involved. And, you know, editing oneself, not always going for the most complicated thing, remembering that sometimes simple melodies capture people's hearts and imaginations a lot more. In fact, probably most of the time, if we're being honest.
True.
Okay, so we played a CD, and now I technically know how to use the big industrial CD player that we have here at Co-op, streaming at co-op.org right now. So the next track we're going to get into is off one of the weirdest albums of all time, entitled 666, The Apocalypse of John. John 3:18, to be exact. So this is a group... This is a double album released by, I guess you would call them a psychedelic progressive rock group, and they're called Aphrodite's Child. It was released in 1972 and is ostensibly an adaptation of biblical passages from the Book of Revelation. The album is most critically acclaimed album this group ever had, though I don't think they put out too many albums, maybe just like a couple. And there were some weird situations, some tensions with the record company, probably not wanting to put out a double album that the cover was just gigantic numbers 666 with red trim in 1972. I can't imagine why that would be tough. But it was, sort of think of it as the 70s prog version of Martin Scorsese's Last Temptation of Christ. Nobody really wants to hear a prog band's take on Revelations, just like nobody really wanted to see Scorsese's take on the gospel, or at least from the Christian side of things. But just like Last Temptation of Christ, the book and the film, this album, 666, The Apocalypse of John, was surprisingly faithful to the source material. This band just had this idea, let's make a double album about the Book of Revelations. And we'll bring, you know, the Book of Revelations is a lot of fire and brimstone. There's a lot of evil stuff. There's a lot of redemption. There's a lot of beauty and light, but it's like the Lord of the Rings. It's all over the place. It takes you on a journey. So I wanted to pick a track off this double album, and I didn't want to pick another long one because we're following up the, you know, the epic Jane's Addiction track. So I picked one of my favorites. It's mostly instrumental with a little bit of dialogue. This one is called The Capture of the Beast, and it's by Aphrodite's Child.
Now comes the capture of the beast.
Thank you. does a whispered prayer get heard? Reverend Bobby's pointing his finger, fire and brimstone's pouring down. Me, I'm wondering what's for dinner, waiting for 12 o'clock to come.
Did you know that you can support Co-op Radio when you use Ride Austin? Nonprofit Ride Austin, created with Austin values in mind, helps harness the giving spirit of the Austin community. When you ride local with Ride Austin, you can round up your fare and designate Co-op Radio to receive your donation. For more information and to download the Ride Austin app, you may visit rideaustin.com.
Support comes from the 10th Centro Americanto Fest, the annual Central American Music Festival taking place Saturday, September 1st at the One World Theater. This festival features multiple musical artists from Central America, including Humberto Vargas from Costa Rica. Traditional Central American food and arts and crafts vendors will start at 5 p.m. Music starts at 7 p.m. More information at cacfest.com or by calling 512-387-0903.
Whose voice was that? I didn't recognize that one.
Wasn't me.
I know it wasn't you, and it certainly wasn't Bob. Definitely wasn't Blacksmith. Who else can we cross off the list? Probably not Fred.
I probably know who that was. I mean, I probably should know.
Probably cross all the dudes off the list. Yeah, so this is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. You're streaming us live. The only way to stream is at koop.org. Before the break there, we heard Drive-By Truckers, Late for Church. That was from their 1998 debut LP, Gangsta Billy, which was recorded live in a studio. Funny enough, that song was written by the guy who played upright bass for the band for, I think his name was Adam Howell, if I remember correctly. He was only in the band for one album. I don't even know if he ever toured with them. Maybe he did for that first tour. But as far as I know, that guy only ever wrote one song, and it was Late for Church. And if you have to only write one song, if you're really just a bass player, and your one go at writing, you produced that song Late for Church. You knocked it out of the park, buddy. Like, you left a stamp on my heart forever with that. So as usual, I've talked too much about, not Jane's Addiction, but as usual, I've talked too much, and there's no way we're going to get through the list. Man, I'm not even going to tell you what songs you're going to miss by me running my mouth too much, because they're so good. You'll just play them all in a row
and don't talk anymore. Come on, let's go now.
I couldn't even get... Nah. I cut it down to only 30 minutes of music, man. Whatever. It's just, there's a lot of talk on this show. So the next thing we're going to hear is from the man himself, Tom Waits. This was the first Tom Waits song I ever heard. I heard it my sophomore year in high school when I was taking a drama class. The teacher assigned us a task of, you know, get three or four students together in each group and pick a song and do a little quick one act based around that song. I was taking that class with a guy who was a senior when I was a sophomore. His name was Graham King. He turned me on to most of the music I still listen to this day. Nice. And he, as a senior in high school in Southeast Texas in the Bible Belt, was not only aware of Tom Waits, he had like 10 Tom Waits CDs in high school. Jeez. That's how hardcore this guy was. And that's why I freaking worshiped his music collection. So he chose this song, Jesus Gonna Be Here, as in what he described to us when he was picking the song, because he was older than us and bigger than us, so he got to do that. He said it was a white trash gospel song. And he had some other great ways of describing Tom Waits. I think he compared him to Captain Beefheart and Dizzy Gillespie. He made a lot of fun comparisons of crossovers between jazz artists and just like insane people. And the result would be Tom Waits. So this is off the 1991 or 92 LP Bone Machine.
Oh, yeah.
And for a lot of people born in the 70s, like Kanye and I, this is probably the first Tom Waits you heard. This album came out after he'd had a little bit of a hiatus, after a triumph of albums from the 80s. He had this trilogy of records that came out in the 80s that were huge. If you were older than us and going to college in the 80s, you definitely had heard of those. But us later 80s, you know, people coming of age in the later 80s and into the early 90s, Bone Machine was sort of the one that hit. It won a Grammy that year. It was one of those Grammys where they did it off air. Like, they were like, aww, as you go to commercial break, like, and Grammys we handed out off camera, Tom Waits, you know, like, we're not going to let this guy on TV. But of course, now he's a national treasure. But at the time, he was still very much just an avant-garde figure. And so we're going to celebrate him tonight with one of my favorite tracks. In fact, the first one of his I ever heard, Jesus Gonna Be Here off of Bone Machine.
Cover!
Support comes from Austin Community College, with an 11th campus now open in Leander. Registration for fall classes and programs is going on now at austincc.edu. ACC, start here, get there.
Underwriting with co-ops is a lot about you and your business. As a co-op underwriter, you join a community of people who are passionate about public radio. When you invest in co-op, you are investing in a station that informs, educates, and entertains. Find out more about becoming an underwriter and supporting community radio by calling 512-472-1369 or go online to koop.org.
I like that soothing music.
Yeah.
I like her enchanting foreign accent. I liked everything about that PSA. KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby, streaming live at KOOP.org. Me and Kanya bringing you the chasing sound. So we heard before the break there, Neutral Milk Hotel, The King of Carrot Flowers, Part 2. It's a love song about Jesus, so of course it made it onto my religious material episode. The song came from their second and sadly final album, at least in their original run, In the Airplane Over the Sea. Kanye and I were just reminiscing about this band. They stood out so much. I don't know what it was. They reached a point where no one was really employing horns, at least on it in a natural way. By the late 90s, Radiohead was using a bit of horns in a weird way, but certainly no small bands were employing horns that much. And Neutral Milk Hotel just brought a fresh, bizarre vibe to the music scene that was very much needed at that time. And yeah, that's probably the best word to describe what it was like to put on a Neutral Milk Hotel CD in 1998. Was like, oh, this is refreshing. this is nice. This is very different and very emotional and beautiful. So actually, we're going to get to play a few more songs than I thought tonight. Probably not all of them, but I'm stoked that we're going to get past Neutral Milk Hotel for a minute there. I thought that would be our stalling point. So the next track we're going to play was originally written by Bob Dylan in 1967. Oddly enough, Dylan didn't release a proper version of this, I don't think, until the 90s. There was a version of it on his, you've heard of the basement tapes, right? This is a collection of recordings that were never meant for mass release. They were just sort of demos that he did with the band, his backup band, which was just called The Band. And they were bootlegged for decades, the basement tapes. They're one of the most popular bootlegs of all time. So there was a version on that bootleg set that was sold illegally a lot called The Basement Tapes, which I think finally got a proper release. And Dylan himself put a proper release, or put a version of this, I think, on his Greatest Hits Volume 2. But whatever, it was forever before there was a proper Dylan version. And it was interesting when Dylan did the vocal for it. It was almost like he was using a voice that you would more associate with the Bee Gees, this high, kind of high-pitched thing that you never hear him do on any other track. So for a long time, if you wanted a good, clean studio version of this song, you had to get it from the group The Band. They put it on their, you know, their famous album, Music from Big Pink, which had that track, The Weight, you know, Take a Load Off, and he had that song on their head. You know, there is not a bad song on Music from Big Pink, and there are a lot of old-timer musicians who say that that album is what stopped the British blues movement of the 60s dead in its tracks. Like, none of them felt that they could honestly play American-style music anymore after hearing The Band. I think a lot of it had to do with the fact that they were Dylan's boys, and that just made them that much more intimidating.
Yeah.
Kind of like the way Hendrix was intimidating in 66 going to London. The Band were just intimidating. They were so good that they made you rethink your whole business. So the track we're going to play by them tonight is their version of Bob Dylan's, I wouldn't say classic, because it didn't get a proper release until much later, and it never really was a big radio song, but it is classic in a way that, for people who love music, it's just an important song. It makes you feel a certain way. The film that Scorsese made about the band called The Last Waltz, which sort of captured their last concert in 1976, last with the original lineup anyway, they ended the show with this, and on stage was, you know, Joni Mitchell, Neil Young, Van Morrison, Neil Diamond, Bob Dylan singing lead, Ringo playing drums, plus, you know, the band's drummer. Just everybody in the world was on stage with this like tearjerker version of this song. So a lot of people look to that version as kind of the definitive one, The Last Waltz, just because there were so many famous people on stage. But for me, this will always be the best and greatest version. This is I Shall Be Released from Music from Big Pink. This is The Band. Thank you. Got us a little fade out music here.
Nice.
So technically you got to log one more song, and I'm sorry. It's
Peter
Gabriel from the instrumental album Last Temptation of Christ.
So good. I love Peter Gabriel.
So here, you could have my page.
I was just next door talking to Blacksmith. He's going to...
What has he got on tap tonight?
Oh, I forgot to ask him that. I was inviting him to my going away party.
Well,
but yeah, he wants us to hand it over to him here in just a few minutes.
We're about to do that, and he's got a cool show coming up, Diamonds and Iron.
Oh, wait, I know what he's doing. It's what that band that he did that pre-record.
Oh, he's got the interview. Yeah. I'm not going to spoil it, but yeah, he's got a guy who's been in a lot of killer bands. He's got a show tonight that's going to, blow your face into hell and back, probably.
All right.
If I remember correctly, he got quite a long interview with that guy, so this might be several parts that you get to hear. But yeah, that's going to be awesome. We're about to hand it over to him. We had so much fun tonight.
Yeah, we did.
We were full of noodles that we ate right before the show, so we probably need to go to bed very soon after we brush our teeth, respectively. But we had a good time doing the religious episode. We got about 1 minute left, so we can hear a little bit more of this beautiful choir that Peter Gabriel put together.